Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another show of At Home with Victoria, with your host, Victoria Gaither, and co-host, Michael Kay.
Everybody, and welcome to another edition of At Home with Victoria. I am Michael Kay, your entertainment co-host for tonight. The lovely news lady, she's going to kick herself when she knows what she is missing tonight, but Victoria is in New York with her significant other and having a much-needed rest and relaxation couple days. So I want to say thanks to her, and she's going to really kick it. Like I said, tonight we have with us David L. Robb. David L. Robb's book, The Gumshoe and the Shrink, just went ahead and hit stores today. He'll be with us to go ahead and chat about that. And then a little later, we're going to listen to the Simmons Brothers, Nashville's own twins, twin phenomenas, and they're here with some of their newest music. So we've got a lot of fun topics. I want to thank everybody up in chat, Mar Ben and Finnegan 2009, Catherine Taddy, Mike Cullip, my brother from another mother, and Sharon Connolly is up in chat. So I want to say thanks to everybody. But without any further ado, this man, like I said, three-time Pulitzer Prize nominee, brilliant fellow, and person that I think is going to be coming back and back to At Home with Victoria, Mr. David L. Robb is with us tonight. David, how are you?
Good, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. So congratulations on the book hitting today. That's available on Amazon.com, and that hit stores as well today?
Yeah, it's in all the bookstores that are left.
Fantastic. Let's go back a little bit to some of your past. You were from UCLA, correct?
Yeah.
And you've worked freelance for the New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, Daily News, Salon.com. How did you get all started up in journalism?
Well, I started in journalism through a poker game. I was playing cards with some professors, and one of the guys worked at the San Francisco Examiner. Said, "Hey, Ira, how do you get in the newspaper business?" And he gave me a name to call, and I got a job as a copy boy back in the 70s. And then I ended up at the Hollywood Reporter and then Variety. I was each of those papers for 10 years each. Those are the Hollywood trade papers, and I covered the unions and legal affairs. And so if you got a call from me, it was a bad day.
You must have uncovered so much dirt back then.
Yeah, I covered Hollywood like it was the docks, you know, the unions and gangsters. And I was a document hunter. I was always looking for documents. I uncovered Ronald Reagan's federal grand jury testimony when the Justice Department suspected him of having taken a bribe from Lou Wasserman. Mm. At MCA, which later became Universal, that gave Universal MCA the right to be a talent agent and also to produce TV shows. And they represented all the actors, and then they put them in their own TV shows. And this was a huge conflict of interest. Mm-hmm. And the Kennedy Justice Department finally made them break up, either be a talent agency or TV producer. But Reagan's federal grand jury testimony, you can't get that from a Freedom of Information Act request. They just don't give it to you, but somebody had slipped it to me. So we had a big story about how he was suspected of having taken a bribe, and this was right during his re-election campaign. So it was a big story. I love documents, and that's how this book started.
Yeah.
The Gumshoe and the Shrink was... it's about the 1960 Kennedy-Nixon election. It's a true detective story. It's about a detective who uncovered Nixon's big secret that he was seeing a shrink.
Right. And that was based on the notes from Dr. Arnold Hutschnecker.
Well, Dr. Hutschnecker was Nixon's psychotherapist.
Oh, okay.
And in 1960... In July, Kennedy was nominated in Los Angeles for the Democratic Party presidential candidate.
Mm-hmm.
But a month earlier, somebody had broken into his doctor's offices in New York, his endocrinologist and his pain doctor, and they turned the place upside down. Filing cabinets were open, files on the floor. Somebody was looking for JFK's medical records because Kennedy always denied it, but he actually had a thing called Addison's disease, which is a disease of the adrenal glands that affects the hormones, the metabolism. It's why he was always getting so sick. If they could prove this and somehow slip it to a reporter who wasn't so picky about where he got his material, this could have knocked Kennedy out of the race. So Kennedy's father, Joseph P. Kennedy, one of the richest men in the country, former ambassador to Great Britain, knew that they had to get something on Nixon. So he got Frank Sinatra to hire a detective, and the detective was named Gunther Reinhardt, who found out that Nixon was seeing the shrink. And I got his report on his surveillance of Nixon, and then I got Dr. Hunsnaker's unpublished manuscript about his treatment of Nixon. So all that's in the book.
Is it true that people in Nixon's camp wanted him to become more like, what's-his-face, his running mate?
Spiro Agnew?
In 60, it was
Henry Cabot Lodge.
Right.
Now, Lodge was a liberal Republican, which they still had in those days.
Yeah, that's going by the wayside. Well, with all of your wealth of experience now, what do you see in the current administration? How are you reading between the lines through a lot of the stuff that's been put out on television and stuff? Basically, right now, I get most of my information on the web. I can't watch news television when it comes to politics. I never know what the hell I'm looking at. But how do you see the climate right now versus the 60s?
Well, in the 60s, there were still moderate Republicans. They had one on the ticket. Today, they've been all run out of the party. The Republican Party has basically gone off a cliff. I think for the last 4 years, President Obama has been trying, through compromise and negotiations, to bring the Republican Party back to the middle a bit, because he knows that if one party goes off the cliff, the country is in big trouble. So he's been trying to bring them back, but that hasn't worked. They've gone off the cliff, and now I think they're gonna definitely lose the presidency. There's no doubt about that.
Really?
And the Democrats are gonna keep the Senate, and they might even win back the House. It depends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I don't. There's between Gingrich and Santorum and the other little freak, Ron Paul.
Yeah, it's Dumb and Dumber.
Yeah, I really don't know. I mean, even if you want to attach a non-judgmental mind in what and how they're saying things, just the absolute level of intelligence frightens me. And I don't think anybody really – would you actually want to be president of a country? I mean, I don't know who the hell would even want that responsibility.
Well, you have to have quite an ego to want that job, and to think that you are the best person in the country to do it takes a huge ego.
Pretty huge ego. And, you know, a lot of them seem to have it. I'm going to go to your first book, The Operation Hollywood, How the Pentagon Shapes and Censors the Movies. I found the premise of that quite interesting, but how does the Pentagon help shape the movies?
Well, when I was at the trade papers at Variety and the Hollywood Reporter, I'd always heard that, and occasionally there'd be a little story about some movie producer who was got approval from the Pentagon to use their equipment, their planes and ships and submarines and personnel and military bases at virtually no cost to help them produce a picture. So I was wondering if there were any documents on this, since I like documents so much. So I started looking around, and I found thousands of pages of documents that the Pentagon had donated to Georgetown University Library Special Collections Department. All the people over the last 50 years that had requested Pentagon assistance on their pictures, and then they would, once you ask for their assistance, they look at you, you have to give them the script, and if there's anything in the script that's negative about the military, they write you notes and say you got to take out this and you got to take out that to make it more military friendly so that people, when they see it, will want to join up and sign up with the Army or the Navy or the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
So I found these documents, and they were just jaw-dropping. I mean, the Pentagon's heavy hand in the production of movies, I think, is something that most people don't know anything about. So it's hundreds of films have gone through this process, and some you can still make pictures without getting their approval. You just don't get to use their stuff, so it costs a lot more money. You have to go to the Philippines and rent their planes and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really the heavy hand of the military and entertainment fare that is really unconstitutional, because the Supreme Court has ruled that the First Amendment means that the government cannot favor speech that it likes and not give the same benefits to speech that it doesn't like. They can't give a tax break to somebody if they write a nice column about the president.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that's what the military does. If you play ball with them, they'll let you use their stuff, but if you won't play ball, they won't let you use their stuff. A lot of films have never been made because they couldn't do it without the military assistance.
Yeah,
so it's a real type of government censorship.
Yeah, like a military sanitation. Catherine Tetti from LA is mentioning, which is a really good idea. But I think sanitization has been throughout. I don't think the average American public is getting the true story of what's going on. I think that we're fed information that we can handle. I think if we really understood what level, I think I would have loved to have been there when Barack had gotten into office and was signing the papers, and then the very next day when he went to work, he got the big book of how screwed up absolutely everything is, and the look on his face, I think, would have been priceless. But I think that has been. I encourage. Do you ever get to the point where you're frightened to uncover some of the stuff you discover?
No. I like to. The more I can find out, the better. I love secrets, and I think what you discover is that people are people, and that there are secrets. But in the end, 20, 30 years later, they don't matter anymore. Now, 20 or 30 years from now, people are going to be finding out what's going on today. It's going to take that long before we really find out everything that's happening now.
Yeah.
But a lot of the secrets are just bureaucratic CYA. You know what that means? Cover your
ass.
Yeah. And so it's a lot of the secrets, they just stamp everything secret. It's not that big a secret. A lot of it is... It's like a lot of these files that came out on WikiLeak.
Yeah, right.
They did not paint the American government in that bad a picture. It they were mostly cables and messages saying how all of our ambassadors saying how messed up all these other countries are. It embarrassed us that our true feelings came out about some of these countries, but it helped spark the so-called Arab Spring.
Mm-hmm.
And who knows how that's going to turn out, but information is good. Light is good. It helps. It's the truth is not scary. The truth is it's good to be enlightened, and it's good to be disillusioned, to get rid of illusions.
Yes. No, I agree, and that's I think up to the discretion of the viewer with the internet. Now there's so many sources of information that you have to really find a news source that you end up trusting in the long haul, because there's so much, forgive the language, there's so much bullshit out there. Some people don't even know what to believe.
Well, there's a great site called Snopes, SNOPES.com, mm-hmm. that people can go to, and it checks out all kinds of rumors and that get passed along on the internet, and it's very reliable as to what's really true and what's not true. It's a great site.
Right.
Recommend it to everybody.
Absolutely. David, we have an active chat tonight, and I have a question, actually, I think coming from Taddy, or coming back from Finnegan 2009. Would like to know, does the Pentagon concern itself with any political slant of movies?
No, it's not. It's not political, although there was a time in the 50s during the Cold War when it was if somebody they made John Wayne take a movie, a line out of one of his movies because somebody said something bad about the government of Taiwan. They made him take that out because they were our allies. And every once in a while, there'll be something like that. But mostly what the military wants is just positive portrayal of the military. So the people see the picture and think, oh, that's a good thing. I'm going to join that. It's not so political as it is definitely advancing military recruitment and retention of personnel, because the military goes, personnel go to see the movies and they say, oh, we're heroes, and they want to stay in.
Mm-hmm.
And it also helps for their funding, and that senators and congressmen and presidents go see movies too, and when they see positive portrayals of the military, which have been, you know, underwritten by the military, they're more likely to want to keep funding the military.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as a political point of view, nowadays that's, they don't lean Republican or Democrat or liberal or conservative.
Another question from California. Has your life ever been threatened by the stuff you've uncovered?
No. And a friend of mine was deeply involved, got in, my old editor, in fact, got involved in the whole Anthony Pelicano thing, in which a big shot in Hollywood hired a private detective to destroy her. And they put a bomb threat on her car, and the police were involved, and the FBI, and there was a huge trial, and all kinds of people went to prison. Very few reporters are killed in America. Don Bowles was killed down in Arizona. But basically, they don't kill reporters here because basically the really bad guys know that reporters don't really ever uncover crimes. But they, good reporters basically just get crumbs from the detectives or police or the FBI, and they're following the trail of the law enforcement agency's investigations. Very few reporters actually solve crimes. So there's really no reason to threaten reporters.
Well, yes, true that, but, you
know. And they're trying. The reporters are not in the bag. I've known a lot of reporters, and I don't, I mean, there are some bad reporters. I had to leave the Hollywood Reporter when I found out for the second time that one of my colleagues was taking bribes.
Really?
And they wouldn't run it, so I left the paper. There are some definitely bad reporters.
Yeah.
But I personally don't know any reporters that are in the bag for the government or the FBI or for anybody that are just, you know, stooges. Reporters generally are trying to tell the truth.
Well, true, true that. You know, this reminds me a little bit of a book that I read a few years ago, well, 10 years ago, so the kind of thing by Julia Phillips, You'll Never Eat Lunch in This Town Again. Brilliant read, but boy, did she ever screw herself in Hollywood.
Well, Hollywood doesn't like troublemakers, you know. In Hollywood, people get blacklisted all the time. There's the famous writers who are all blacklisted because they had been or suspected of being communists. And myself, I'm basically blacklisted at both papers because I exposed one of my colleagues for taking bribes. And at Variety, I was blacklisted because when I left there to go to the Hollywood Reporter, I wrote about what a crook that the editor was there. The editor was actually a mobbed-up guy who used the paper to help his friends and hurt his enemies. It was a former production executive who took over one of the great Hollywood trade papers, Daily Variety. He's finally retired, but before that, Variety had been run by this family, and it was a great paper.
Yeah,
great family, great news company. They didn't care about if it hurt advertisers. They were a great paper, and then this new guy ran it into the ground. It was really shameful.
Yeah, no.
But blacklisting is very real in Hollywood. If you make
absolutely.
They don't like it.
Absolutely. I was, prior to my radio little career here, I was a hairdresser, and believe me, hairdressers get blacklisted. I think everybody and everybody in their own chosen profession have a list where you can totally screw yourself out of being popular. But between government and Hollywood, what is your most interest to cover?
Well, I like them both. I really like I like covering government. The American government is, I think, the best government in the world,
mm-hmm.
but it's got all kinds of secrets, and I like to find out secrets. And Hollywood is really the cultural center of the whole world. We have dominated the world not so much through our military, but through our culture. Our culture mm-hmm. has taken over the world. The Roman Empire couldn't even do what we've done culturally.
Mm-hmm.
So Hollywood and government are really, they're separate, but they often come together, and there's a lot of connections. And between those two things, well, the military, the government, and Hollywood pretty much sums up everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I like them all because they've all got secrets and they've all got fascinating people who run in those circles.
Yeah. Another question from chat, Taddy from California. How powerful do you think is Hollywood in putting candidates into office? I don't think that's really, I don't think it's up to Hollywood.
Well, I think that Obama probably owes a good portion of his election not so much to Hollywood, but to guys like Keith Olbermann and John Stewart and
mm-hmm.
David Letterman, who were ridiculing McCain and Palin every night. Ridicule is the worst thing that can happen to a candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And they were ridiculing. It was so true and so funny. I really think that they might have tipped the scales. And not
yeah.
just those, but as those are examples of the media sort of weighing in, and Bill Maher also on the Politically Incorrect, just basically making a fool of the other guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be very damaging. I don't think they really ever recovered from the ridicule that they got. So
Well, no, there was just so much material, though. I mean, Palin alone, when Tina Fey took over The Imitation and basically just recited some of the things she said verbatim.
Yes, Tina Fey.
And it became heavens.
It destroyed her, and I think it really helped Obama huge.
Once
a person has become a laughingstock, it's very hard for people to vote for him.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing more powerful than humor, and nothing more hurtful than to become the town fool.
Yeah. What did you happen to catch Sarah Palin's little show where they followed her around in Alaska?
Yeah, it was ridiculous.
Yeah, I couldn't see the purpose of it. I don't know.
Well, it was just promoting her as a soccer mom and a outdoors woman and
her brand. Lunatic. Yeah. That's just it. Everybody's got a brand nowadays. The more I hear about it, be true to your brand.
Yeah.
It makes me laugh, but it's a viable.
A brand used
term.
To be a bad word. It's something they did to cattle.
Right.
Now it's like a good thing.
Metaphorically, absolutely. I'm going to go back to the chat room and everything. Where are we here? There's so much chat in the chat room anyways, but so let's go back to The Gumshoe and the Shrink. It's available in every bookstore, Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com. Are you on social media? I tried to look you up on Facebook, and I don't notice you there.
Yeah, I got a Facebook thing. My wife does that for me.
Okay. Do you want to go ahead and share that with the audience? How can people keep in touch with you?
I have an email, davidrob88@aol.com. And there's a Facebook, David Robb. I don't know. I don't even have a cell phone. So I can type really fast.
Yeah.
And I'm good looking up stuff on the computer and finding secret documents. But the technology, I sort of skipped a step or something. And once you miss one beat, bam, it's past you.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Facebook, I thought it was, I really did use it more or less just keeping up with relatives, and now it's, 98% of my business. I find it just so fascinating. Let's talk about Pulitzer. Nominated for three. Nominated in 1994, 96, and 98.
Yeah, I was at the Hollywood Reporter, and I was doing a whole bunch of work on the... the blacklist, the Hollywood blacklist, back in the 40s and 50s, the House Un-American Activities Committee, on which Richard Nixon sat as a congressman, was looking into everybody's politics, and if you wouldn't answer their questions, Hollywood would blacklist you. You'd be banned from working. So all these writers, directors, actors got blacklisted. But I was focusing on a lot of the writers continued writing under fake names or under using fronts. And so I set about finding out all the movies that were written by these people under different names and who the real writers were on these. So I wrote a bunch of stories. And my publisher at the Hollywood Reporter really loved those stories. And so they nominated me a bunch of times for over the years for that. And for my coverage of the unions and coverage of minority issues in Hollywood, African-Americans, Hispanics, American Indians. I was basically the complaints department. If somebody had a complaint, they'd send them to me.
And you actually won the NAACP Image Award for Journalism in 90.
Yeah, I got an Image Award for covering their issues, which are fascinating. Merle Evers, who was the executive director of the NAACP for a while, she was out here for the Image Awards one year, and that's the awards they give to Hollywood for positive images of African Americans. And I asked her, well, how have things changed? This is in the 90s, early 90s. I asked her, and she was the wife of Medgar Evers. She was the widow of Medgar Evers, the great civil rights leader who had been assassinated in Mississippi. And she told me, well, things have changed a lot. When she and Medgar were in Mississippi, they would watch the Ed Sullivan Show, and Ed had a variety show on CBS, and he was a kind of a progressive guy. He would have black acts on his show, Lena Horne and Nat King Cole. And in Mississippi, whenever a black act would come on his show, the CBS affiliate there would go to dead air.
Really?
Just the hissing. And that was it. And then when they were done, back with the guy juggling or some slapstick comedian. And nobody even reported about it. That's just the way it was. In 1961, when parents were married, they couldn't have gotten married in 17 states in the South because marriage between black and white was illegal.
Really?
So things have changed a lot, and that's one thing I always try to encourage people to recognize, is that things really have gotten better in so many ways. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that blacks and whites couldn't get married, and now the debate is whether gay people can get married. But it's happening much faster. It took 100 years for blacks to get married after the Civil War to a white person or a white and now gay marriage is legal in, I don't know, 5 or 6 states or more.
Yeah, it just became legal here in Delaware actually in January.
It's amazing.
I'm really honest to God, never thought that I would have actually lived to see that day.
But I live
in
California.
Kind of
California
edge,
turned it down, Proposition 8.
They've been flip-flopping for the last few years, though, on that.
I know. They put in a Schwarzenegger. This is the bluest state in the country, and they keep, I don't know, they're fooled by Hollywood sometimes. Ronald Reagan was out of here. They started him, too, California.
Yeah. I'm going to go back to the chat for one last question from Finnegan 2009. What do you think of Michael Moore?
Well, Michael Moore is a fantastic provocateur. He really raises the questions. I was not happy with Bowling for Columbine because I had known Charlton Heston for many years. He was a former Screen Actors Guild president. He was always in the mix in SAG politics, and I knew him quite well. One time I was on vacation in Alaska, and he called me up there. He was a great guy, nice guy, very accessible. And in Bowling for Columbine, Roger Moore showed up at his house, let him in, and then he accused him of killing all those kids at Columbine because of his support for NRA. Well, I thought it was a cheap shot.
Yeah.
Other than that, I really like, you know, Michael Moore's thing is sort of the cheap shot, but when it happens to somebody that you know, you feel differently about it.
Yeah, it hits a different level.
Yeah. But otherwise, his capitalism movie, is the movie he did about
healthcare.
Healthcare. Roger and me, they're great and provocative and thoughtful and clever pictures.
Yeah.
And I think he's a real he's really out there always giving it to him.
Yeah. Which is what everybody needs to do is, like I said, be disillusioned.
Yeah.
Like you said, be disillusioned, because it's the only way we're going to actually get our heads out of our ass. But, David,
yeah.
we're out of time, my friend. You're listening to David L. Robb, his new book, The Gumshoe and the Shrink, hit stores today. You can also go ahead and find it on Amazon.com/David L. Robb. David, you're a fascinating man. I can't thank you enough for taking the time tonight.
Well, Michael, I sure appreciate it. You asked some really good questions, too, so thanks a million.
Well, thanks, buddy. I really
appreciate
it. Say hi to
Victoria for me.
I certainly will, and I have to go ahead and do this technically. I have to say anytime, you know, you're at home with Victoria is always waiting for you. So, buddy, I thank you so much for joining us tonight.
All right. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
That was David L. Robb, author, The Gumshoe and the Shrink, like I said, available in pretty much every bookstore now. Fantastic and fascinating guy, and we've got to have him back on. But all right, people, I've been waiting for this all time. Nashville twin sensation, the Simmons Brothers, is going to be up just in a little while here. I'm going to go ahead and start off with the obvious choice, because right now we're going to party like a rock star with the Simmons Brothers.
She partied like a rock star.
Party like a
are the Simmons brothers. I'm going to go ahead and actually, Chris is actually calling in on the other line right now. We're going to give him a second. Maybe he can hear us and actually give us a call right back. But I want to go ahead and thank our last guest, David L. Robb. Going to go to the chat room a little bit here. Yes, we got Talking About Home coming up, and Sandy from Nebraska just went ahead and posted the Simmons Brothers new video, which is kind of exciting. So I can't wait to go ahead and talk to the Simmons Brothers. But hold on for 1 second. I'm just going to go ahead and take this, see what happens. And no one's there. Anywho, hope you're enjoying the show tonight. Let's go back to chat and want to give a thanks to Finnegan 2009, guest 7035, guest 7087, guest 7193, guest 7555, guest 7803, Catherine Taddy from California is in the thing. Marby from Nashville producing another fantastic chat room. Mike Cullop, my brother from another mother, Sandy from Nebraska, and Sharon Connolly. But let's go ahead and see if this is who we're looking for. Hey, is this one of the Simmons brothers?
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, how are you doing? Who am I talking to?
You're talking to both of us. We got you on two separate phones that feed into the same line.
Fantastic. Sorry I dropped your line there, but how are you guys doing tonight?
We're doing really good. Really good. We've been listening to you guys all afternoon.
Enjoying a glass of wine.
Yep. Kicking back in Nashville.
That's what I like to hear. So let's walk down memory lane. You guys started singing at the age of five.
Yeah, our mom, she had us in a little trio with our sister Cindy at the age of 5 years old, and we went from church to church, and we sang, and she was kind of really strict about it, too. You know, she made us rehearse all the time and practice, and we were actually singing three-part harmonies at that age.
Wow.
And But she was really talented herself. She played piano, and of course, her mom and made her and her brothers and sisters do the same thing whenever they were young too. So it's kind of a tradition, you know, especially when you get in the, you know, the Southeast or West Virginia, Virginia area. There's a lot of music there, and
mm-hmm.
pretty much everyone can play an instrument.
You guys sing at school and stuff too, growing up?
Oh yeah. I was in. We were first of all, you know, it's kind of funny. We were in the band, but we were also like captain football team.
Mm.
But it was a weird combination for Curtis and I because I was in all-state choir and, you know, they had a lot of training that way. We sang, you know, we were always singing, always playing. Had our first band when we were, 14, around there. And we actually even played at our high school for talent shows and, you know, the normal when you're that age kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, got our first paying gig. We got paid $35. Big deal.
Birthday party, yep.
Yeah, bought a bunch of Boone's Farm, Mad Dog 2020.
Yeah, don't hide anything there, Chris. lay it all out there.
Right under the bus.
Yeah,
that's it, under the bus, definitely. Yeah,
I have to say, though, growing up in West Virginia Hills, to be singing in school and quarterback of the football team, that is quite a feat. How did you end up getting to Nashville?
We actually moved here. We started on some affiliation with a record label called Blue Desert Records. And we started recording and stuff with them, and then the label, we seen where they were going with their direction and where they were going, you know, more technologically than anything, because me and my brother, we love technology, and we try to keep up with it as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people at that time, 6 years ago in Nashville, there was just a reckoning because everyone who wanted to be an artist couldn't become an artist because you had to wait on the major label to sign you up. And then all of a sudden, one day we woke up and rolled out of bed, and hey, you didn't even need the label anymore. All you needed was a computer, upload your stuff, and you can sell your music. I mean, and so it kind of just changed everything. And those who weren't willing to evolve technologically into that, I think they closed their doors. I mean, there's a lot of empty places down with music right nowadays. And that's probably why.
Yeah, and I think that also increases the amount of, and I don't mean this the wrong way, but with everybody doing their own music, no one filtering them. There's a lot of crap out there, but there is a lot of really excellent work out there that I can't believe aren't being picked up by a lot of people. That either they're not part of the machine or are not, brand worthy or what have you. But I think that gives people like the Susan Boyle sort of like a forum where plucked from obscurity, but man, did she climb fast.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the market at one time was, there was 100 artists making millions of dollars, and now there's millions of artists making hundreds of dollars.
I know.
I heard that
said
one time. And that's the way it's working because oversaturation of the market. I mean, it's like any other market. And there's so much out there that it's hard sometimes, you're right, to pick out. You know, there's some people that are so talented that they might be able to just stand out alone. But then also, like you said, there's the catch-22 where there was a lot of people who were talented before and would never get a chance because maybe they didn't fit the status quo of what beautiful should be, or they didn't have the style that someone else thought they should have. You know,
I, you know, Curtis, I think the anchor of that, though, is radio. You know, radio still to this day, I mean, Curtis and I have, you know, been a lot of radio stations and heard our music, but to actually get played, you know, put on the playlist, to be played by the program manager of a Cumulus station or a Clear Channel, you know, station, a big station, and be put in rotation is like winning the lottery. It's that hard.
Absolutely. And I think, too, it's also for 95 Hot and all those radio stations, they're so commercial-driven. I don't know if it's just me lately, but it seems like I'm watching television and all I'm watching is commercials. So I have this thing where I will just simply switch channels. And same thing with the radio. Internet radio is the only place that I find that you can actually get a full, you know, hour down of a good sound bite, get the story in without having, you know, every 5 minutes this screaming jingle in the back of your head. My biggest thing to hate right now is that stupid pig that flies down the road screaming, "Wee!" Oh, my God. I just want to crush that little – I want to make bacon is what I want to do.
You want to make bacon? You want to crush the little piggy that went to your freezer?
I would.
Yeah, I mean, you're right, though. I mean, you're definitely right. But, you know, I thought whenever we first started – whenever the Internet started making web radio stations – at first, I was a little skeptical about it, you know, because XM, that kind of stuff came out, which is not web-oriented. It's more just, you know, no commercial, blah, blah. And me and Chris talked about it, and the thing that it was missing was a DJ. You know, there's something about listening to someone talk on the radio.
Yep.
I love it, and
even talk about something that's happening in your town. Now, maybe you don't want to listen to, you know, the little piggy on the Geico commercial, but you really want to hear what this guy's got to say about Aerosmith coming to town tonight, or maybe there's a parade going, or something that's just happening, or, you know, or talking about daily events. And if you don't have that, that's the only thing that I think can never change and probably never will for, I mean, in my lifetime probably, that everyone wants to hear their local DJ or their celebrities, well, celebrities to them, you know, whether it be a morning show, you know.
Well, it brings life to it. It does. You know,
yeah.
Of course, I have iHeartRadio on my phone. Plus, I have AOL Radio. You know, iHeart Radio. You got a DJ AOL Radio. You just stream of music nonstop. You know, you pick rock, and it's rock nonstop.
So you can also pick stations too, though.
Oh, absolutely. But you guys just did a staged concert. Was it last weekend?
Yeah, we did one 2 weeks ago. Actually, our first one, and I had not been familiar with staged.com, and some friends turned me on to it. And Jake Owen and them had did a couple Spare the Moment shows, and Jared Neiman, and I said, yeah, let's try this. So I, you know, signed up and thought, well, you have to request to be accepted by them, and they accepted us, and I said, well, let's do one tomorrow. So we just picked it the next day, and we did an acoustic show,
which is a lot of fun.
And it was, it's 30 minutes, and then you get a 20-minute encore, and it was really cool. I mean, a lot of people showed up. People were, you know, they can talk to you via chat room from wherever they're from. I mean, there was people from Alaska and people from all over the place.
Brazil,
weird places. Yeah, and you're getting these requests, you know, and if they want to hear a song, they can actually tip you in a tip bucket via online.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you make any money that night? Because actually, you can also. So it makes it worthwhile.
Down, man,
plus, I think the audience prefers that over going to. Because I was talking about this on Facebook, saying that, God, this so beats getting a shower, shaving, getting into the car, driving to the concert hall, parking, bumping it. You know, what a great idea. I can just put my house coat on and sit in front of, you know, my computer and get a fairly good quality. What was the quality of picture like? I didn't catch it, but was the stream really good, too?
Well, the stream was awesome because I used straight-in Ethernet, but I have a brand-new Mac, and it has their, you know, high-end, was it like 7 to 10 megapixels, I don't even know what it is, somewhere on there. The clarity on the camera of just that laptop is unbelievable anyway. So it depends on what you have on your end. And you can also get, like, external cameras that they can approve. There's a list of stuff on Fidget.com that tells you what the specs are and that you need as far as even operating systems all the way down to, you know, if you're going to use an interface and run a mic through it. But just using a laptop, I mean, I used a MacBook Pro, a new MacBook Pro, and turned it around, pointed it towards me and my brother on two stools, and we went at it. I mean, it was great. It was a lot of fun.
We actually have a person here right now. Did you see it? Was it pretty clear?
It was awesome.
She was really clear. So yeah, everybody that I talked to, Curtis, they said that it was really clear. They could hear it really well. So
fantastic. Well, are you guys planning to do more of these? Because I think it's a nice way of making a little bit of coin.
Yeah, I mean, we did one. We're experimenting with it a little bit. We did a live show last Friday night in West Virginia, and we just we turned it on, and we used it. We weren't really sure about, you know, as far as the audio feed, and because a live venue is so loud, even though we turned it down as low as we could, it was still a little bit distorted. So we learned a little bit with that, you know, what to do with it. You know, if you're going to play a live show, you're going to need an external mic. You're going to have a way to move the mic away, the video camera, make a zoom type thing.
But the you know, the acoustic one that we did the other night, we're going to probably try to do that. You know, I thought, oh, Curtis, you know, maybe set a date like every Thursday if we can, every Tuesday.
It's going to be every Tuesday.
Every Tuesday. And we're going to bring the whole band in. We have like what they call a cajon, which is like an acoustic drum thing, and then we have like our banjo player, you know, and
we'll have a bass, and we'll have, of course, me and my brother playing on guitars. And it'll be really cool because we're going to invite a guest every week. So
good idea.
Might, yeah, and so every week in our, because we have a studio in our house, and we're just going to invite people over and have them do the stageofdotcom thing and help them get some exposure. Because, and then another thing too is, if they're part of our little group, then we can share Facebook, you know, together too. So their fans, our fans, everyone, like your fans, whoever is interested in seeing a really cool show, and it's the best part about it is, it's like you're in our living room. I mean, you are in our living room.
It's intimate.
And it's
literally.
Intimate. Yeah.
You got to hide all the paraphernalia before you start doing those. But you know, our good friend of mine, Shelley Rand, is right in Nashville there too. So she, you know, I don't even think she knows about this. I got to go ahead and send it to her because I think that's a great idea. But I think we're going to listen to a little bit of more your music and start to satisfy some of the cravings from this hungry chat room. So we're going to take your questions for the Simmons Brothers after this. But let's listen to the Simmons Brothers talking about home. Don't go anywhere.
It was green, not because it was cool, but it meant something to me. It was the first tractor that we owned, John Deere. Holding my jeans, Diver style, hauling wood back from the old farm. Got me warm all winter night. Help outside of the farmer's farm. I'm on the front porch shouting, the covers on. Hot window, shout the name if you got it in ya. Raise your glass if you know what I'm talking about. It's a swimming hole and I was clean. The girl you've been kissing since you were 16. Grab a plate, pull up a chair and get you some. Talk about. Friday night, West Virginia moonshine feels right on a sunny day on a riverbank. Georgia beach, so sweet. Florida sun, summer fun. Fly away, sweet Caroline. Bigger country in Tennessee. Bluegrass country. Old Kansas seats on early night. Talking about home. Hot the window, shout the name if you got it in ya. Raise your glass if you know what I'm talking about. It's a swimming hole and an ice cream. Girl, you've been kissing since you were 16. Grab a plate, pull up a chair and get you some. Talking about. My daddy used to drive, blaring that old 8-track tape, singing, take this job and shut it. Massey Ferguson in the front yard, plowing fields, man, it was hard. I can still hear my granddaddy say, son, life's a garden, you might as well dig it, boy. Talking about home, hot the window, shout the name if you got it in you. Raise your glass, you know what I'm talking about.
since you were 16. Grab a plate, pull up a chair, and get you some. If you like the way that tastes, come get you some. Talking about the cold. Back to Tennessee, country roads take me home.
Simmons Brothers, talking about home. You guys both did a tour of duty.
Yeah, we both served in the United States Army.
Yeah, I'm actually wearing my Army shirt right now.
One of them. How long are you guys in the Army?
Well, no matter what they tell you, you got 8 years regardless.
The contract is
they might tell you three, they might tell you four, but that ain't the way it works. You know, I mean, which is fine. I mean, you know, you have to do your certain time. I ended up, you know, doing the four because 9/11 came along, and then they activated everybody back again, and we just kept doing like full time reservists, you know, having us back. And so I guess it was about 2003, 2004 before we even got to.
Curtis went in a year before I did, and because he was a chemical specialist, and he went in after a heartbreak. Anyway, that's another long story. But he showed up on my doorstep one day and said, "I'm leaving." I said, "Where are you going?" He said, "Going to the Army." I said, "When?" He said, "Right now." He got in the car, and I was like, "Where are you going, man?"
Yeah.
And we were twins. We were best friends. I was like, I wanted to kill him. But so I went down and started talking to the recruiter. But after that, then we both went, though. And, you know, it's kind of funny because we were so, you know, stationed close together sometimes. Like he was in Fort Hood, and I was in Fort Sam Houston twice. And I seen him one time for about 15 minutes the whole time I was in the Army. And we really didn't even get to see each other until we got out, which was...
they don't let you out much.
No, they don't.
No. So you guys weren't even stationed together at all?
No, no.
We ended up...
They kept us apart, too.
Until the very end, of course. Then we ended up being at Fort Bragg together for a little while. Then we went to... we were part of a unit in West Virginia in Beckley, medical unit.
Because, you know, you got an option. You can get out, and you can do inactive reserve or reserve. So when you get out, you know, we stayed in reserves, and we got a reserve unit in West Virginia, even though we didn't live there, and so we could go back once a month and try to see our family and that kind of stuff. And then, of course, that's been some time ago now. We're out.
Yeah. We're well, on behalf of all the times, on behalf of all the times you haven't heard it, I do thank you sincerely for serving. I think that's so incredibly admirable, and I'm thankful that you guys got out. And then I'm reading here you got out and did 1,200 shows in 35 states that you guys got out.
Yeah, we hit the road, I mean, pretty hard, you know, because we figured that the only way we were going to make it big, you know, like I said, the Internet was just now starting to kick off a lot of music stuff, and we thought if we went from state to state, and we would do well. But we went ahead and we recorded an album, which is horrible. To me, it was, anyway.
Yeah, it wasn't
horrible. It just I don't want to say it was horrible because you shouldn't talk bad about your own stuff, but as far as a musician, I look back on it, you know, and I think, well, but back at that time, you know, we were like, man, this is awesome. And fans thought it was awesome, too, because we sold thousands of copies of it. And
it was a big transition. People don't, you know, there's so many people that are in the music business now, the younger generation that are just coming up and coming to Nashville. They don't understand that, you know, 8 years ago, to make a quality album was like $50,000. There wasn't
right.
This, let's go get our garage band and Pro Tools and rock it out, you know, because the Pro Tools was like $5,000 back then. You couldn't do half the stuff you can now with it.
Yeah, and it sounded really digital, so we ended up, we cut it on tape.
Yeah, we went to Kitty Wells Studio.
You know, cut it on reel and then dumped it into Pro Tools. Anyway, everything's changed so much. Well, yeah, we started in North Carolina, and we bought a bus from a preacher man. And broke down in Raleigh. That's how far we got it.
Yeah, we got about 10 miles.
Those who don't know, that's still in North Carolina. We didn't get out of North Carolina. We bought us a bus, they're bringing it back to us. They were changing tires. My aunt was our road manager at the time and our business manager, both of them at the same time. And my uncle was the driver, and the whole back end of the bus just fell out in the middle of the intersection.
Really?
The middle of downtown Raleigh.
Everything.
Yeah, so they went and had it towed. Well, my aunt's a really big optimist. You know, she's a glass half full type of gal, you know, or half full of wine or something. And she says, well, okay, so they pulled in the hangar and they're putting the new rear end in the back of it. At the same time, she called up a graphics company and had them come paint on the back of the bus, the Simmons Brothers, and put our website on there, which was
good.
At that time, it was
pretty high speed, you know. People weren't really promoting their websites that much. You know, yeah. Friendster was still the head thing. MySpace was starting to crank up pretty good.
Facebook didn't even exist,
you know. And,
right.
But so she put that back here, and she goes, yeah, we're going to get everybody to go to your website and buy your songs. And I'm like, okay.
Well, this is before they had 9-asset downloads. And well, actually, it was so funny because Curtis and I sat in Anderson Distributing, which is where, you know, Walmart, and this was in 2003. And Curtis said, they asked us how we were selling our music, and we said, well, we're 9-asset downloads on our website. And they're like, how do you do that?
Well, I mean, they knew. I mean, of course they did, but I guess they didn't think it would be very effective. And
yeah.
And of course, it's all on who receives. You know, having a device that can receive that kind of thing. And at that point, only computers were the only thing you can do. Then you burn a CD and go get in your car. I mean, mm-hmm. And now of course everybody has an iPhone. You want to hear a song, you just go to iTunes or Amazon.com and download it and put it in your iPod.
Yeah.
And,
but you had mentioned about the gigs. We were actually telling funny stories about some of the gigs we've had.
Yeah.
We have definitely paid our dues, man. We played from the smallest 200-seater with 13 local drunks sitting at the corner of the bar to, you know, the 10,000 to, you know, way more big, huge venues. And
yeah.
We were, you know, telling stories about being like in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I went and played this place one time, and I went and we checked into our hotel rooms. And I go in, I lay down on my bed, and I look up on the ceiling, and there's this huge stream of blood on the ceiling.
And for those who don't know anything about Albuquerque, New Mexico, if you've ever seen
Cops is filming,
you've ever seen Cops, the show Cops, they've always got an episode of Albuquerque, New Mexico on Cops.
We love Albuquerque, but man, come on.
We found out why. It's awesome.
But it was like, so I'm looking, and I see like pieces of like brain and stuff on the ceiling.
And I'm like, he's getting the script of it, and you're on your radio show.
And I followed it all the way to the door. And I was like, oh my God. So I went to the front desk and said, there is like blood and like matter on the ceiling of my hotel room. She said, yeah, he said, somebody opened his door and got his head blown off there last week. We haven't got a chance to paint it yet. He said, we'll get back to it.
Yeah.
Well,
it was only blunt
high,
force trauma.
High. Huh?
It was only blunt force trauma. No big deal.
Yeah,
that'd be great.
The last thing he went through his mind anyway.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you know, and it's funny he was telling Albuquerque's story because I was telling one today, too, about a woman who she invited us to come to her house. And we went to her house, and she's like, do you want to see my guard dog? And I'm like, yeah, sure. And she takes us into the back of her house, and then in the back room, she had an open closet. And in the bottom floor of the closet, there was like a 50-foot snake. And I am not joking. Literally,
16 feet.
I don't care how big you say it is. That thing was huge. It has had a head big as a Rottweiler. That's all I know. Anyway, those are just some of the fun things. But that's, I mean, guess what makes everything? You know, because you play the same show over and over and over and over. But it's the people you meet. And that's what that song Home, I think, is a lot about because – you know, no matter if we were in New Mexico or if we're in Yuma, Arizona, or South Florida, or
Valdosta, Georgia,
or wherever, New York, it didn't matter where we were at. We ended up having our own little set of people at those places, you know, in off Alabama or wherever, that would make us feel home.
That became our family, you know, away from it. It keeps you sane, brother, let me tell you, because, you know, our band, they were all, you know, hired at going salary, so when we were off for 2 weeks, they all got to fly home to their families and to their homes. And Curtis and I, our address was the bus.
Yeah.
So if we were in, you know, California, if we were in Georgia, wherever that bus stopped, that's where we found a KOA parking lot, and that's where me and Curtis lived in with Gary and Linda, my aunt and uncle.
Yeah.
That's where we stayed. And we're talking Vienna sausages and potted meat sandwiches.
Yeah. It would take 3 of your radio shows to get the whole town and the whole thing.
Oh, well, then we've got to have you guys back on again and again. We're going to go up to the chat room right now. I got a couple of questions for you guys. Curtis and Chris, who inspires you from Sandy from Nebraska?
Sandy from Nebraska, let's see. Inspirations, of course, when we were younger, my dad listened to Johnny Paycheck, and whenever George Strait came on the radio in 1981, I was sold on that. And then at the same time, we were inspired by, and I am, I can't speak for Chris because even though we're twins, we're two.
Well, give three
people
that you got inspired by, Chris, and I'll give three.
Of course, okay, I'll say three musicians, period. George Strait, AC/DC, Boston. That's three.
Really?
The spectrum, big time. And Led Zeppelin, too, don't forget that.
And me, Chris, I'd have to say that, you know, one of my biggest influences that's not country was Boston because of the harmonies. I mean, the high harmonies. And I figured if I could sing as high as they could, then all the other stuff would be easy. So that's where I learned how to mostly sing that and my mom. And then, of course, you know, I loved Merle Haggard. I liked, you know, the nasty country, you know, Merle Haggard and
Waylon
Jennings and Willie Nelson, those kind of types. And then, of course, you know, like I love Journey. Journey was just a...
I think the one person we can agree that it would influence us both a whole lot would be Elvis Presley.
Elvis rocked.
Yeah. He, my dad loved him, and there was nothing he couldn't sing, you know, period. So I think everybody, you might hop on that same bandwagon, but, you know, me and my brothers had the privilege of watching, like, old home videos from friends of his that had it, and the man was just brilliant in every way possible, you know.
Yeah. Wow. I'm going to go back to the chat here a little bit, back with Sandy from Nebraska. She, which is a good song. Who writes lyrics? Who writes the song? Do you guys both write together, or does one come up with a melody, one come up with the lyrics? How does that work?
It's pretty much just 50-50. Curtis and I are just like, hey, man, I got an idea for a song. Really? Okay. He's like writing, sure. And next thing you know, we're into it, you know. And we usually don't, you know, Curtis and I have been blessed to have each other. I was born with my co-writer, you know. So
yeah.
When we finish up a song, I don't think any of us, either one of us, ever remember who wrote what lyric.
No.
And for one of us to say, hey, I wrote most of that, you would never hear that come out of one of our mouths. Unless we were actually fighting with each other in private. You know, we are brothers still, you know. But when it comes to being in public, I mean, I don't think we would ever even tell anyone that we wrote a certain part or whatever.
Yeah.
So,
we're absolutely, and a damn good one at that. I'm going to take some email question. Deborah from Dallas wants to know if you guys are single. I think Deborah's got something itchy.
Deborah, you can go ahead and reach to the internet and kick his hide in right now for saying you had something itchy. No, my brother, actually, he is engaged to one of the most beautiful women I've ever seen in my life, and they have a beautiful young little boy together, and I am divorced and currently actually single at this moment. So, yeah.
The one Simmons brother is available.
That's usually how it always runs.
That's the end of life for him.
The end of life for me. So.
She might beat him up. She's a
southpaw. Guys, we're running out of time. So sorry, we're running out of time. Do promise me you guys are going to come back on.
Oh, of course. Oh, yeah, we'll come back on, definitely.
Absolutely. Where can we find you now? I found you on Amazon.com/Simmons Brothers, but let's give us some addresses here.
I'll give you an address. Let's see. You can always Google the Simmons Brothers, and because we do our work when it comes to putting us out there on the internet. But you can find us also at ReverbNation.com/the Simmons Brothers, Facebook.com/the Simmons Brothers. You can find us on iTunes, Rhapsody, Amazon.com, CD Baby. Of course, and all those things, you can just search the Simmons Brothers and find us pretty much anywhere
you
want.
If you Google us, you'll find us.
Of course, on our home website, www.simmonsbrothersmusic.com. And it's been reformatted at this time, but it's still up, though, and you can go through there and see our next tour dates. And we're going to start doing, like, giveaways and free downloads to singles and letting people have some free music. And
Have you got to see our video?
I did. I am part of Like a Rockstar song, and I also watched your EPK, which I thought was, you know, quite charming and stuff with your producer. What was his name? Ron or
Rick Webb?
Rick Webb.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I thought the EPK was hilarious. I love how you sell to venues. I think it's bright.
Yeah, we're just a bunch of goofballs, and that's pretty much
we're having a blast.
We're not changing much anytime soon. So. But I tell you one thing, we really appreciate you having us on your show.
Oh, yeah.
And,
buddy, the pleasure is all mine. But I do want to thank you guys both for coming in, and just to remind you that you have a permanent home here on Homes Victoria. So do come back and let us know what you're doing, what you got on the pipeline, okay?
Definitely will.
Come out if you ever get near. If we get near, come out and watch us. You always get free tickets.
Absolutely. Hey, I'll buy the shots.
There you go.
That sounds good. These are free, even. That's what's even best about it. So we can just
I
take the free shot
price.
And the free ticket. How's that?
Sounds great. Buddy, thank you so much for calling in tonight. I really appreciate it. And again, good luck for your future endeavors. You guys are brilliant and keep partying like a rock star, okay?
All right. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Take care.
Good night.
Good night, Chris and Curtis Simmons from the Simmons Brothers. Yeah, we got to have them back on. There's so much I didn't get a chance to ask them about their cooking and everything. If you know the Simmons Brothers, they like to cook a lot, and they like to post their pictures and stuff. So they're a couple great guys. I want to thank you all for tuning in tonight. I want to go ahead and actually make a quick mention to a good friend of mine, Anna Johnson, has a new video coming out on the 21st of March. So we're going to play her song Someday coming up in a little bit. But I want to thank Finnegan 2009, all the new guests, Catherine Taddy from California, Mar Ben from Nashville, Mike Cullup from Maryland, Sandy from Nebraska, and Sharon Connolly. Thanks for being here for the first time. I don't know where you're from, but I hope you had a great time. We're going to go ahead and close the show out with Anna Johnson and her song Someday. You can go ahead and keep your eye on my Facebook page, and we will post it as soon as it becomes available. But good night, everybody, from Michael Kay at Home with Victoria. Vic, I hope you're having fun in New York, but till next time, this is Anna Johnson, Someday. Good night, y'all.
Four. Oh, not your average, everyday kind of girl. She walks along alone on the highway, opens up her guitar case to sing. Glad to meet you, here I am. She says sometimes when it rains I cancel my plans, catch all the drops in my hands, listen to the beat, beat. Life can be so sweet. Yeah. Magazines with toilet pages, old jeans with holes, she's worn for days, but who cares? It's okay. Someday she'll be on the big stage, singing about those rainy days, singing songs and blowing clouds away, far away. She knows that someday, ooh, someday her dreams will come true. Someday she'll sing them for you. Someday you'll want to go too. And someday you'll find that you're out, and then you'll never give up. Just keep living the life, loving yourself, and your dreams will come true.
With Victoria, an interactive news and entertainment show on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Download us on iTunes as a free podcast and like us on Facebook. I'm Shelly Rand, musician and announcer for At Home with Victoria. Download my CD on iTunes and Amazon and friend me on Facebook.